So discussions of world governance and national sovereignty and all the conflicts between the two are woven into news headlines this morning as nations of the euro try to coordinate their national fiscal policies. But 200 nations have already been working to try to create a new political process for addressing climate change in Durban, South Africa. Delegates from around the world agreed on Sunday in Durban to forge a new deal that would eventually replace the Kyoto Protocol. For the first time, the Durban platform will force all the biggest polluters to limit greenhouse gas emissions, including emerging economies like China and India. Joining us to discuss the complexities and the viability of this new process is Andrew Light, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and professor of philosophy and public policy at George Mason University. He was at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Durban. Professor, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
So how difficult is this this process, and how likely is it to be more successful than Kyoto?
Well, I think by definition, it's going to be more successful in Kyoto because the rules that were set back in the early 90s for Kyoto ensured that there would be this firewall between developed and developing countries, no matter how big they were, no matter how big their carbon footprint and the amount of carbon pollution that they emitted. And so essentially, we created an agreement where, by the end of the day, only about 15% of carbon emissions were covered under that agreement. The new agreement, the new track we're on, the Durban platform, as they call it, will include all the major polluters in whatever they wind up agreeing to.
Yeah, it's been fascinating the last couple of weeks with the discussions of sovereignty over in Europe regarding the financial crisis that they're having, and then this very different discussion of political philosophy over climate change. Where does the rubber really hit the road in this Durban platform where governments can be compelled to do things maybe that they might perceive as against their national interests?
Well, it's actually kind of a byproduct of a very weird sort of system that they've set up there. Because the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change could never agree on their operating rules, they've acted with a de facto consensus process. So all 194 parties have to agree on everything. And for various reasons, there were a lot of things kind of queued up to move forward this year, such as the Green Climate Fund, which will mobilize tens of billions of dollars to advance mitigation and adaptation around the world. There were a bunch of little moving pieces there that everyone wanted to get through, but they had to come to a consensus on these bigger things, like resetting essentially the entire treaty process in order to have that happen. So because there was so much at stake, I think the parties were more willing to agree to this big move forward because they didn't want to lose the smaller pieces.
We're talking with Andrew Light, who's the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and professor of philosophy and public policy at George Mason University. Andrew, evaluate this dispatch from our partial dispatch from one of our colleagues at the BBC, Richard Black, who was really describing where the political momentum emerged at this Durban meeting.
The small island developing states had a good conference because they dug their heels in and they weren't cowed by any of the big boys. I think the EU had a good conference. They set out to lead the agenda. They didn't get everything they wanted, but they got most of it. The US had a very good conference because I think they came here basically wanting to remain as invisible as possible so as not to give any ammunition to the Republicans, but also to not disenchant their key supporters who they need to go around and knock on doors. Who had a bad conference? I think that some of the African nations themselves could possibly have been a bit stronger.
It's Richard Black, a BBC correspondent in Durban, South Africa. Is that a fair assessment? Did the island nations help to really drive this?
I think the island nations helped. I think they certainly did. But I really do think at the end of the day, you know, it was the big carbon polluters who were outside of the Kyoto Protocol, the United States, China, India, you know, that had to come together to make this happen again. In fact, the EU, who sort of set the agenda and said, you know, we want this big agreement on a post-Kyoto future protocol to take in effect in 2020, they're the ones who put those cards down on the table. And fundamentally, they were complaining throughout that this was turning into a G2, basically, between the U.S. and China driving it. And I think that fundamentally is like how they got the agreement, is you got the big polluters to come in, the United States pulling China in to this agreement that they play by the same rules as everyone else.
So how does that two-tier G2 system get dealt with, say, 10 years down the road? The goal here is to have a fundamentally new platform entirely in place by 2020, I believe. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So what's the next big obstacle here to keep the G2, as it's called, in the protocol, in the platform?
Well, the what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to figure out the technicalities of, are they going for a new protocol, something that will be legally binding, that will take legal form. So there's lots of things they're going to have to do there. I think that, in fact, what's really going to be driving the agenda in the next, and through the rest of this decade is this new green climate fund that they created, because that is really the only part of this process which will actually get additional tons of carbon out of the system. As you say, whatever new treaty they're going to decide won't take effect until 2020. What you got to do now is get projects on the ground that are getting carbon out of the system, and this Green Climate Fund is going to be the principal mechanism for making that happen.
So, Andrew Light, give me a picture of a place around the world where this Green Carbon Fund might actually be put to work in a project that might tangibly show that this Durban conference has achieved something here.
Sure. So in January 2010, a little over 80 countries said what they were willing to do unilaterally in order to try to hold temperature increase caused by climate change at 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. And many of those parties said, here's what we're willing to do in terms of, renewable energy or energy efficiency or land use change, forestry, something like that. But they also said, here's what we're willing to do if we had more access to finance and technology. So a concrete example, Indonesia said they're willing to do a lot in terms of preserving their forestry and peatlands to reduce the emissions that happen from the burning of those landscapes. And they said what they were willing to do with more technical support and finance. So what this fund will pay for is more forestry and peatland projects in a country like Indonesia.
So in as many as 80 countries around the world, actual projects are being pulled off the shelf and are likely to be funded and implemented as a result of what happened last week.
That's right, exactly. And a bunch of different organizations had been teeing up projects, like basically saying, there was a lot of conversation there. Here's an example of a new solar mission in someplace in Asia. Here's an example of a new, hydro system that could go in Latin America. They were all kind of displayed in Durban, and so people really saw that if you want to pull the trigger on those projects, you got to get this fund going, and if you want to do that, you got to get this big agreement done.
A green IMF. Very interesting. Andrew Light is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and professor of philosophy and public policy at George Mason University. A lot of philosophy down there in Durban. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, John.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.